Okay, thanks. Okay, so this is, well, the title's here. It concerns the predictions of signatures of p-width superfluids and Majorana modes using RF absorption in atomic gases. And this is a work in collaboration with Adi Stern's group, the Weizmann Institute. The work was done mostly by Eitan Grossfeld and Ronnie Alan, and what I'm describing is reported in more detail in this paper. So in this audience, I don't think I need to say, give any motivation for the interesting physics that one can see in Fermi gases when you have S-wave pairing, and the new regimes one can achieve when you tune the strength of the S-wave pairing between two-component Fermi gas. So based on that, it's of course interesting to ask what new physics might arise if one has a one-component Fermi gas and looks at possible p-wave paired states. So p-wave required, of course, because now the pair wave function has to be anti-symmetric in its spatial wave function. We know from studies of superfluid helium-3 that p-wave superfluids have a rather more rich structure than S-wave superfluids, in part because of the additional range of order parameters that can arise. One can break time reversal invariance and parity in various different ways, leading to different p-wave paired ground states. But in addition, these phases have got some rather different collective properties. And in particular, and of relevance to this talk, is a particular phase called the weak pairing Px plus Ipy superfluid, which I'll describe in more detail as we go through. But this has particularly unusual features. In particular, when you take the superfluid in two dimensions and introduce a vortex, say by rotating the superfluid, then these vortices are predicted to have localized zero energy bound states on the cores, which are Majorana fermions. So there's this set of one Majorana fermion on each of the vortex cores. And this set of zero energy states leads to a ground state degeneracy of a system containing a large number of vortices, which when you then braid the vortices around each other, gives rise to non-abelian statistics of the vortices. So this idea of non-abelian statistics of these collective vortex variables in a Px plus Ipy superfluid is a very interesting phenomenon of the collective property of this superfluid, and it underlies the reason for the predicted non-abelian exchange statistics in quantum Hall fluids. The so-called the Moore-Reed state at 5/2 is based on exactly this physics, and there's a very hot experimental effort underway to try and detect these non-abelian statistics in the Majorana modes. So our, with that background, our motivation for studying this issue came about because of theoretical predictions, largely from Victor Guerrari and his group, that the ground state of a p-wave atomic Fermi gas, an atomic Fermi gas interacting with a p-wave Feshbach resonance can realize this px plus ipy weak pairing phase. And therefore, we were interested to see what one could see, measure concerning these properties of these Majorana modes and these non-abelian statistics. And the bottom line of the whole talk is going to be that if one uses RF absorption spectroscopy, one can see very clear and distinctive features of the different p-wave superfluid phases that arise in this Feshbach interacting system. And in particular, one sees very clear and striking signatures of the existence of Majorana zero modes on the cores of vortices. So just to be clear, the bottom line is that we can propose that one will be able to see these Majorana zero modes. We're not being ambitious enough to say that one can detect non-abelian statistics, but at least one is one step towards that. One is showing the existence of these zero modes, which are crucial if there is to be any non-abelian statistics in these fluids. Okay, so by way of outline, what I'm going to do is I'll start by describing the phase diagram for a single component Fermi gas interacting with a p-wave Feshbach resonance. And I'll describe what I mean by weak and strong pairing px plus ipy superfluid phases. I'll then go on to explain what RF absorption is. RF absorption spectroscopy, and I'll calculate the absorption signals for these different ground states, the weak and strong pairing PX plus IPY superfluid phases, and show that one can distinguish those quite cleanly in the RF absorption spectrum. I'll then go on to discuss vortices and Meyer anemodes. Explaining in more detail what these Meyer anemodes are, why they exist in the weak pairing phase, and finally finishing with the calculation of what you would expect to see in the RF absorption spectrum if you have a rotating superfluid with some vortices with these Meyer anemodes on the cores. Okay, so that's where I'm going. Please do stop me if you have any questions or if anything's not clear. As far as the phase diagram goes, first one has to have a model to study, but again, in this audience, I think everyone's very familiar with the standard model for an S-wave Feshbach resonance, where you have a two-component Fermi gas with a resonant interaction into some quasi-bound state or some closed-channel molecule that in the S-wave case is, of course, an S-wave, a molecule with no angular momentum. The natural generalization to a single component atomic gas is to have a resonant interaction into a molecule which now has angular momentum 1. So one has a resonant interaction into a molecule with angular momentum 1, and one looks at the collective properties of this two-component system of atoms and molecules. Now, in the there are a few differences from the S-wave case. One difference, of course, is that because this molecule has got angular momentum 1, there should be three projections of that angular momentum that you should keep track of, so there are really three molecular levels to consider. And the other difference, and this is one that's been emphasized by Victor and his collaborators, is that because of the nature of the P-wave interaction, at low energies, the interactions between the atoms become weaker and weaker because the atoms have to tunnel through the centrifugal barrier in order to get into this molecular bound state. And as a result, for a low-density gas, one is always in the so-called narrow resonance limit, where the rate at which molecules dissociate into free atoms and then recombine into molecules is small compared to the energy of the atoms themselves. So it's small compared to, say, the Fermi energy. So Victor and his collaborators have made extensive use of this.
So you want to ask a question?
Yep.
When you said you've got this Feshbach resonance and you go into this closed channel which has got L equals 1, but does it have to have L equals 1? Presumably, assuming the matrix elements that couple the two potentials don't mix, say, spin and orbital angular momentum, like dipolar ones.
Well, so if there are dipolar forces, there can be splitting of the three levels.
Yeah.
So you need not have perfectly degenerate the three projections of the angle momentum need not be degenerate with respect to, say, the direction of the spin or the hyperfine level. So there can be a coupling between those, and that will lead to a splitting of the three levels. But in the simplest model, I'm considering the simplest model where there's no such effect. I can comment on that if you like, and it's been studied as well. So since the resonance is narrow, one can justify the use of mean field theory. Mean field theory becomes quantitatively accurate. And so Victor Garari, Leo Radizovsky, and Antonov Andreev had made use of this to derive the phase diagram of the system. And here I plot the phase diagram in this particular case where there's no splitting of the three molecular levels, so that there's rotational invariance in the of the molecular state that's formed. L equals 1, 0, 1, and minus 1 are all degenerate. And the phase diagram looks like the following. Here we have temperature. On this axis, I'll plot the position of the molecular level relative to the bottom of the atomic band. And there's a transition which rolls over at about twice the Fermi energy of the atomic system. Above this transition, the system is normal. And below this transition, the system chooses to form a Px plus Ipy superfluid phase, which actually is divided into two regions, which the so-called strong pairing side and the so-called weak pairing side. And these are separated by a line, which I'll draw here. And the line is characterized by the fact that the chemical potential changes sign at this point.
Can you elaborate on omega naught, what that is?
Right.
Presumably there's some picture.
Yeah, so in the usual picture of having some open and closed channels, omega naught will be this is the open channel, and this is the threshold of the open channel. Omega naught will be the energy of some molecular state in the closed channel relative to the dissociated atoms in the open channel. So it's the position of this molecular bound state relative to two free atoms at large distances from each other. So as omega naught passes through zero, one goes from having a situation where there's no bound state. So at omega naught.
Okay, so this is the thing that you tune through the Feshbach.
Yeah, exactly. It's just the usual Feshbach resonance. That's right.
But the narrowness means presumably as soon as you move it a bit below the vacuum level, you won't be getting the closed channel, which is your strong pairing, is it?
That's right. Well, it's a good.
It's very different to the normal case of the resonance that usually brought, and that doesn't happen.
That's right. So it's a good approximation to treat the molecular level as condensed with weak fluctuations due to dissociation of the molecules into atoms. That's right.
Okay, what's the physical reason why Px plus Ipy is stabilized? Is this because infinity is the possible
frame where you just open over again? Well, OK, so I don't have a very good intuitive picture for that. I mean, one can look at the mean field energy and see that it gains most by having pairing. And I mean, the competing phases are things like Px.
So basically, you just open over full gap. That's usually stabilizes the mean field theory. When the mean field is the best estimate, then usually you open over full gap.
That's.
But I don't know whether that's enough.
Well, what one has.
There's a better intuition.
But there's no anisotropy here either that would favor the other kind of state either, right? So, I mean,
I think the argument is, E vector has to point some direction. You're already breaking a rotational symmetry, isn't it?
There is so in three dimensions, this of course breaks rotational symmetry because you have to pick x and y. So there is a direction up the z-axis where actually there can be a node in the excitation spectrum even for px plus ipy. I don't have an intuitive explanation as to why it should be that phase as to another one. Perhaps in the picture.
When I gave this Monday talk a few weeks ago, I was saying that. As far as I understand, on the BCS regime, you use this biggest possible gap argument. In the BEC regime, the gap is already there regardless. And so I don't have an intuitive argument, but I have an argument based on scattering. That particular scattering with a spin flip favors Px plus Ipy. And actually, in that talk, I went through the argument.
I see.
Why it faces it.
OK. So. Just to be clear, so these phases are ones where the order parameter is proportional at small momenta to Px plus Ipy. And as I just said, in three dimensions, this breaks a symmetry because it picks out the z-axis as special. And of course, if there's rotational invariance, we could have chosen any axis. What I'm going to discuss, I'm going to focus on a quasi-2D limit where we confine the atomic gas to some quasi-2D layer with a confinement that's energy that's larger than the Fermi energy. In that case, the z-axis will be selected as the axis normal to this layer, but still there will be two degenerate states, which are the Px plus Ipy phases corresponding to whether the orbital angular momentum has got plus one or minus one with respect to the z-axis, and this relates to the fact that this phase breaks a time reversal symmetry. So it chooses the molecules to choose to rotate in with plus one unit of angular momentum or minus one unit of angular momentum with respect to the z-axis. Okay, so what I want to go on to say now is what the difference is between the strong and weak phases, and to do that, I'll describe the excitation spectrum of these phases within the Bogoliubov-Degen approach, which again is justified in this narrow resonance limit where mean field theory is accurate.
Sorry, can you answer this is a question before we get onto that?
Yeah.
In the strong pairing moments, where these things are rather small, is it known what the analog of the 0.6 is?
Victor is busy calculating.
Is whether it's negative. Is that it? Was it?
So we have the sum over momenta, psi k dagger, then we have the pairing term, which will have psi k dagger, psi minus k dagger, times a pairing function, and for the px plus ipy superfluid, this will be something that's proportional to kx plus iky. And then to give this dimensions of energy, I'll multiply it by something that has dimensions of a velocity, which is the size of the pairing order parameter, which I'll call V delta. And then, of course, there's the Hermitian conjugate. Okay. And then we proceed as usual, introduce the Bogoliubov transformation, and write some Bogoliubov quasi-particles alpha k in terms of u's and v's times electron and hole operators mixing, electrons at plus k and holes at minus k, and then the Hamiltonian is then given by a sum over k, ek alpha k dagger alpha k plus a constant, where this energy comes from diagonalizing the quadratic form that one obtains in this Hamiltonian. And the result for these phases is that Ek is the square root of k squared over 2m minus mu squared plus v delta squared times k squared. And again, I'll focus on the regime where we just have a quasi-2D system, so k squared is just kx squared plus ky squared. Now, in terms of the spectrum, one can see a distinction between the weak and strong pairing phases. So remember, weak pairing has got a positive chemical potential, and if I plot the excitation spectrum for the case of positive mu as a function of k, then it starts at a value of mu when k is zero. It then comes down, goes through a minimum, and rises again. And this is just like a weakly coupled in the BCS limit. It's a weak coupling BCS theory, where here the excitations are essentially, for a Fermi gas, we would have a dispersion that looks like this. We'd have hole-like excitations here, and then electron-like excitations on this side. And of course, the superconductivity has opened up a gap. In the strong pairing case, the excitation spectrum has a minimum at k equals zero at a value of the magnitude of the chemical potential. And then it rises smoothly from that.
Now the dashed line you draw in the top one is for S waves.
The dashed line would be if there was no pairing at all. If I just set V delta equal to zero and I just had a Fermi gas, then I would have then the excitations would be for this would be the Fermi momentum. The excitations would be that the excitations above the chemical potential would be making holes at wave vectors less than kf, and they would have an energy which is given by mu minus k squared over 2m to create a hole at a wave vector k, and then the excitations above kf would be electron-like excitations, and relative to the chemical potential, they have an energy k squared minus mu, which is just this parabola. The spin state, so, well, these are spinless. So the spin state, in what sense? I mean, the okay. So here I'm looking. These are spinless electrons. So I'm just considering one component fermions. So we can think of spinless electrons, spinless fermions. Yeah. So that was. I guess that was important over here, right? But I didn't have any labels other than k, so I had k with minus k.
I had thought maybe you subsumed the spin index into the wave.
Yeah, no, it's even simpler than that.
So these, in fact, are just a single hyperfine state.
Exactly, yes. Sorry, I wasn't clear on that. That's right. There's just one hyperfine state for the atoms, at least whenever they're very far apart. When they're in the molecular level, it could, of course, involve mixtures of hyperfine levels in some more complicated way. But the theory is for spinless particles.
Does it make a difference if they were spinless?
Well, it doesn't make a difference. Right. Well, then I guess in superfluid helium, we can start thinking about how if the spin orbit coupling, we can start asking how the spins orient themselves with respect to the angular momentum of the orbital angular momentum, and so there are transitions and phases to do with that. Beyond that, I'm afraid I can't say much.
Richer structure.
Yeah.
I guess little phase A1 of helium 3, where spins are effectively polarized.
Right.
And also, as far as I understand, I've been told that I've never checked that up in phase A, there are also half-lux vortices, which effectively behave in the same way with Majorana fermions.
What is the A phase again, as far as where the D vector is to L?
Okay. Will you be able to reproduce this? It's neither. It's neither A1, so A1 is when spins are polarized, B is when spin is parallel to the other parameter.
Okay.
And then there is A phase, which is a third option, and I don't remember what the third option is, but what's the one remaining option which you can do with the spin?
Where you can polarize it and still have the Majorana fermions, you're saying? Because usually you can't pick out a direction and have a single direction for the spins, right, and have the Majorana fermions.
No, you can. So this is all.
The D vector has to be able to rotate.
This will have Majorana fermions, and there's no spin at all.
Well, if you don't have any spin, then you don't have any problem. Yes.
Okay.
I agree.
Could I ask a slightly different question to head away from the spin, although not completely? So obviously, I guess there are some collective modes at low energies or something, aren't there?
Yes, that's right.
So one of them is sound, and that depends on the 0.6 type calculation to know what the speed of sound is.
Yes.
But I guess you could also, in principle, ask about the exciting one that appears to have the opposite angular momentum. Again, in 2D, so you don't have full rotational periods, but mm-hmm. at least you could have, as you said, PX and IPY. So.
Well, that's. Okay, so I'm not sure where that sits in the spectrum, whether that you think that's a gapless mode or a.
It probably depends again on the scattering length of that with the.
So I'm not sure. I mean, this of course, these are the particle-like excitations, and you're asking about collective excitations. I don't know exactly how that one fits in with the sound mode.
I think in this particular context, you can't distinguish collective excitations from single particle excitation, at least the Sarah spectroscopy, which you talked
right.
about.
Right.
Only sensitive to a single particle.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so these two phases differ in the structure of their excitation spectrum, but in fact, they differ in a more fundamental way. One can show that there's a topological invariant that changes as you go from one side to the other, and so actually the two phases have got qualitatively different. And one of the consequences of this that we'll see later in the talk is that in the weak pairing phase, the vortices have a Majorana zero mode, whereas the strong pairing phase, there's no Majorana zero mode on a vortex core.
So, I have a question. When mu is positive but small, I think the upper picture already becomes kind of like the lower picture, even before mu crosses zero. Is this correct?
You say the minimum can disappear.
That's the deduced from your paper.
Maybe as you go to a strong coupling, you end up just with one minimum.
I guess.
You end up with just one minimum even before mu crosses zero. All which needs to happen is at some point that value mu becomes actually smaller than the value of the minimum. That happens.
That's right. Yeah. So as you're saying, as you bring this down and you're keeping V delta constant, at some point this can come below here, and so you'll have a single minimum. That's right. But so the transition is actually when mu equals zero, and at that point the spectrum becomes linear and at large momenta, and then it lifts off again as with a parabola. So the transition is not the shift in the minimum, but the point at which mu goes through zero and the spectrum goes through a point at which there's a linear dispersion. Okay, so what I'll do now is just to describe RF absorption and say what one would expect from RF absorption for these two phases. So the RF absorption that I have in mind is analogous to what's been done in the groups of Debye Jin, also in the group of Rudolf Grimm in the spectroscopy of an S-wave superconductor. In that case, you've got two fermions in the system, two Fermi species in the system, but you drive a hyperfine transition between one of these fermions and another hyperfine level, which does not participate in the pairing. So there's one level that participates in pairing. There's some other level in the S-wave case that is pairing with this level. But one drives a hyperfine transition to another third level, and you look at the number of particles that are driven into this level by having an optical transition, just doing optical imaging on the number of particles that are left behind or on the number of particles that are transferred. So you can measure the rate at which particles are transferred from one of the levels in which the pairing is occurring into some vacant hyperfine level. And the spectroscopy comes by varying the frequency of the RF source and looking at the rate at which atoms are being transferred as a function of the detuning of the frequency relative to the bare hyperfine transition. So in the case that we're considering here, there's no extra level here. We just have the hyperfine level of the atoms that we've been considering so far, and I'll label that for convenience as being the spin-down level. And then I have some empty hyperfine level that I'll label as spin up. And this is just used for probing the excitations from spin down to spin up. And they'll be driven by some perturbing Hamiltonian, which we'll take to have some amplitude eta related to the strength of the RF field. There's some frequency omega. And then it drives transitions to the, say, to the spin up level from the spin down level, and it does this with a zero wave vector because this hyperfine transition is at such a low frequency. Now, for the final state, in order to understand the effect of this in the spectrum, one has to say something about the interactions of the final state atom with the initial atoms. And so firstly, we're going to assume, well, essentially we're going to assume for most of this that there are no interactions. One interaction that we can rule out convincingly is that this spin-up atom will not participate in the Feshbach resonance with the spin-down atom, because these Feshbach resonances in P-wave systems are very narrow. We don't expect that this particle will also have resonant interactions with these particles within P-wave. However, one does, now that one has a new species, one should consider the possibility that there are S-wave interactions between the spin-up electron and the remaining spin-down electrons. And as I said, for most of this, I'm going to assume that these interactions are negligible. One can, of course, include interactions within some sort of mean field theory. And in that case, one finds quantitative shifts of the features that I'm going to describe. There's no qualitative change. But in addition, at the end, I'll come back and mention that one can perform the calculations for the spectroscopy of Meyer anemodes in a limit where you have very strong interactions between spin-up and spin-down in the S-wave channel. And in that case, you can see explicitly that there's no qualitative change in the excitation spectrum. Yeah?
So compared to the energy scale strength, the Fermi energy in the system is, you said, large compared to omega naught, or what is the Fermi?
So the Fermi energy, it's set by the density. It's going to be tens of kilohertz, but omega naught will go through the Fermi energy. So omega naught is comparable.
Kilohertz. Yeah. And this omega that you're looking at?
This is megahertz.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's much larger than omega.
It's much larger, right?
So the sign of the interaction also doesn't matter.
So the sign of the
interaction between the up and down species.
It may do. The case that I'm going to discuss is that where we've studied things is where we have repulsive interactions, and there actually. So the point I'm going to say is that we can imagine if you excite from an atom from a vortex core, it may be that the final state atom feels attraction to the vortex, because there's a density depletion in the vicinity of the vortex, and that's somehow the regime where you would expect the strongest effects of the final state interactions. But what I'm going to show is that the qualitative form of the excitation spectrum looks quite similar in that case. In the case where if you had attractive interactions, you might say that the atom that was excited in the vortex core would then be distributed somewhere else, and then you can imagine that there's just some simple mean field shift in the final state. But so the sign will matter, but what I'm saying is that at the level of the qualitative features we want to describe, those are robust to the, including some form of interaction. Okay. So as I said, for the most part, we're going to neglect interactions. So let's just do that. And I'll write the full Hamiltonian for the system. Well, it will be the part for the spin down atoms that we've discussed over there, which I wrote down with a chemical potential in. So what I want to do is to have a Hamiltonian for non-interacting spin-up electrons. And for it's more convenient to include a chemical potential for that as well. So when we change from spin up to spin down, we don't change any. We're counting energy from the chemical potential in the same way. And then we can say that the bare energy gap, EG, comes in as a term, EG N up minus N down. And then that'll be the perturbation that drives transitions between these two levels. So the absorption spectrum.
I'm confused about this chemical potential.
Yeah.
Because the chemical potential at N down is because you have a finite density of that material. But as far as the N up, there's nothing to begin with.
Well, it's just a zero of energy. I'm just saying, there was no Hamiltonian, and I change N down to, I remove one down particle and make one up particle. Then this is minus mu times N down plus N up. Yes, but I've done it because this is what we always write for Boglou of Degen. So if I want EG to represent the bare transition energy, I have to subtract off mu times N up at this point. I'm just being careful with where the zero of energy sits. So the absorption spectrum then is just given within Fermi's golden rule. as a sum over some final states or excited states of the spin down system, which I'll label A, some excited states at the spin up level that I'll describe B. There'll be a matrix element of this perturbation between these levels, and then a delta function where I'll conserve energy with, there's an excitation energy for the spin down particles, there's the excitation energy for the spin up particles, and then I've moved one particle from down to up, so I gain EG, and then I have to subtract off the frequency of my source. So this is just Fermi's golden rule, conserving energy. Now, okay, again, I'm because these energies we're counting as being the excitations. So let me go through the case for a Fermi gas, because then I hope it's clear what these things mean. Right? So if I can get that right, then it's that hopefully you trust me. So for a Fermi gas, what would we say? Well, the excitation energy for the A particles is this function that we just discussed before, where we have a hole-like part, right? We have excitations which are hole-like, and then excitations that are electron-like. So so in the Fermi gas, the transition will be given by 2 pi, the sum over k states. If we're going to remove a particle from the spin down case, we're going to have to create a hole, so we can only, it'll only have a matrix element in this part up to the Fermi momentum. So we sum over k less than kf, then we'll have the matrix element will be 1 because we'll go to some plane wave state of the same size. Then we have the energy of the state that we've created, which is a whole state with energy mu minus k squared. We'll create, so we add that to the excitation that we create in the final state, which is k squared over 2m minus mu. Okay. So this is so EG is still this bare. It's EG is still the bare energy difference between these two hyperfine levels. So the point of this is that everything cancels, right? So we just get a delta function at EG minus omega, which is just saying that we have vertical transitions from a band of fermions to another band with the same mass, and so we just get a transition at the bare the energy difference between those two levels.
Why is it then EA and not negative EA? Do you think that the A is excited that you shrink the gap?
So it's because EA is the, we're measuring energies relative to the chemical potential. So, and these are excitations above the ground state. So the this is the total excitation energy.
But the A and AB, they're both positive?
They're both positive.
But here it looks like since they cancel, if one of them is positive, the other has to be negative.
No, hold on. No, look, okay. This is positive, so I get, so this one, this is negative, right? This one has to be negative, right? Because the,
mu is where you cut the axis,
right? It's, okay, I'm not sure what else to say. I'm presenting this in this way because this is a consistent way in which we can count for the zeros of energy, and I'm forced into doing that because in the Bogoliubov spectrum we always have something that looks like this, where these are positive excitations, And the way that this reproduces the Fermi gas is that we have to be careful to subtract off mu times the chemical potential here. So as you say, this can be negative. It's an energy, but it can be negative because of this thing that we've subtracted off. And the net result for the Fermi gas correctly gives us that we just get a transition at the bare difference in the energies between the two levels.
So can we say that the A particles are still in their ground state? So removing a particle, of course, excites it, and that's why EA is bigger than zero. But B particles, presumably, they're not in the ground state, at least with respect to the chemical potential, and so they can have negative energy.
Yes.
Adding a particle, they can lower the energy.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's a useful way to put it.
You did just particle transformation.
Yeah. There's nothing very deep here. It's just this.
So I mean, he did that because it's convenient in the context of pairing. And then when you go to the normal state limit, and when you take out the square root, there's a sign and ambiguity, and there's a negative sign. That's why.
Okay, so with this, we can then go ahead with confidence that we can do the Bogoliubov-Degen case, and then gamma of omega, we now sum over the excitations. What we need is we can only make an excitation if it has if there's some possibility that it will make a hole in the system. So because we're trying to pull a particle out, we have to have an amplitude that the Bogoliubov excitation corresponds to the loss of one particle, one spin-up particle, and this is given by the component vk squared of the Bogoliubov excitation. So we get a matrix element that's related to vk squared. This was the thing that was 1 for the Fermi gas here and 0 outside. And then we have a delta function on the energy of the excitation, for these spin-down particles, the Bogoliubov energy. Then we have the energy of the final state, which is again just a free particle measured relative to mu, and then Eg minus omega. And so from this, we can now go ahead and put in the spectrum that we have and the VKs and calculate the absorption spectrum. So the result is the following. Well, I'll just put so that's delta omega plus mu. Delta omega is defined to be the frequency relative to this bare energy Eg. We have 1 delta omega plus m v delta squared, well, squared, and then it's multiplied by a theta function on delta omega. If mu is greater than 0, that's if we're in the weak pairing phase, or it's a theta function on delta omega minus 2 mu if mu is less than 0. So what does this show? Well, if we plot what the absorption spectrum is as a function of omega, then in the weak pairing phase up here, we get a threshold when omega is equal to Eg, and at that point, omega is equal to Eg, delta omega 0, mu is non-zero, we get 2 mu here, so we actually get a step. So there's a threshold, and then a step, and then there's some function that falls off eventually. So this is if mu is greater than 0. And if mu is less than 0, then the threshold is now at Eg plus twice the modulus of the chemical potential. So it's shifted upwards. And at that point, we have delta omega is equal to 2 times the modulus of mu. If I add 2 times mu, because mu is negative, these cancel. And actually, you find that the spectrum grows linearly above that point before falling off. So what you find is that there's actually a differences between these. Well, for one thing, is that there's a quantitative difference that the position of the edge is shifted, and this is shifted essentially because in this case, to create an excitation in the condensate, we have to break a pair, and we break a pair, it costs us 2 mu to take 2 particles out of the pair up to the into atomic levels. But there's also a qualitative difference that in this case we have a sharp step and a threshold, whereas here there's a linear rise.
So that would have been the same for the S wave as well. For the usual PCL basic resolver, presumably.
That's right. That's right. This comes from matrix elements in PK, which I take a similar form, I think, in that case.
So in the Fermi gas, you just got a single delta function, because sum over k, there's nothing k dependent inside the case. Is that right?
There's nothing k dependent, sorry, where?
In the Fermi gas.
That's right, so because the k is cancelled here and the matrix, that's
so,
right.
So in the Fermi gas, you get a delta function absorption.
Yes.
And as soon as you go superconducting, the absorption just spreads out over.
That's right. Well, it's spread out to. So the delta function is spread out to higher energies. That's. You might wonder, well, why isn't it equivalent up here? But actually, you can check that there's an offset which has pushed this up to higher frequencies. That's right. The first in the weak pairing phase, because the pairing vanishes if k goes to zero, then actually the bit just at the these transitions are exactly equivalent, which is essentially why there's still a threshold exactly at EG, because the particles here feel no pairing and they're just like the Fermi gas, so that's why the threshold happens exactly at EG, but the all the other states are pushed to higher energies.
So I guess you
could
this like being a tunneling experiment.
Sorry. Well, it's this is at k equals zero rather than tunneling. You would sum over many. You don't resolve.
And you would get a delta function in tunneling in the Fermi gas. So not tunneling.
Yeah.
It's
like absorption. Yeah. It's all just completely translationally invariant.
You're asking in.
Your problem, like you've got nothing that breaks. Translational merits. I'm worried about something like a Cohn's theorem. You know, why you get weight
yes.
at other energies. Okay. So
the Cohn's theorem doesn't hold here because I have no the interactions between up and down are different from the interactions between down and down. You might think of it like spin resonance, and there'd
right.
be Larmor's theorem.
Okay.
But that relies on spin rotational invariance, and this is broken because I have no interactions. Okay, so that's the first part, and saying that even for the ground states in principle, there should be this qualitative difference in the absorption spectrum that can distinguish weak and strong pairing phases. Now, what I want to go on to do is to discuss vortices, Majorana modes, and the spectrum in that case. So let me turn to that.
Asymptotes really have an offset which just shows up out to very, very large.
Well, this is the function. This is the full function. So you can look at, there's actually you can check as a function of frequency, this actually goes like 1 over delta omega.
Okay.
So it actually goes like 1 over.
It is actually very
so it's actually broad. That by itself is a bit of a sickness, and it tells you that because this the integrated weight is not finite, and so you have to worry about that. But that comes because we've made this assumption that the pairing is just k plus ik. At large momentum, we ought to cut that off at some point.
Okay.
And so eventually this will go wrong at large frequencies for some other reason. But that's the function. So I now need to go ahead and describe the Bogoliubov excitations above vortices, and I'll go through this quickly because time's running on. Firstly, we need to be able to describe Bogoliubov excitations where the order parameter is inhomogeneous. And the appropriate thing to do in this case, if we imagine that the inhomogeneity is on length scales that are large compared to the pair size, we can introduce an operator which is given by the following, dx plus I dy. Then I have now my pairing velocity amplitude, which depends on position. I make the symmetrized version of this with dx plus I dy. Then the Bogoliubov problem boils down to something that looks like the following. These are now operators that we can think of as acting on functions in space, u and v. H here is p squared over 2m minus the chemical potential. Delta is the operator here. This is delta dagger. And if you were at Victor's talk, Blackboard talk a couple of weeks ago, you'd have heard him describe some of the symmetries of systems of this type and the possibility that you find zero modes. So zero modes meaning E is equal to zero. And in that case, as he showed, you could, because of the symmetry of this problem, you could show that the function U could be chosen to be equal to complex conjugate of the function V. Now, I don't want to go through that, but I just want to have some specific results. And the specific results that we care about are for the case where we have a vortex. So let's say V delta of R is equal to some magnitude V delta, which could depend on the radius, but let's just choose it to be constant, times something e to the IL times the an angle theta around some origin. And the statement that I require is that for the weak pairing phase, there is a localized zero mode. And this is in the case where this vortex has got an odd circulation. So this is if L is equal to 2n minus 1. So this has been discussed in various ways by various authors, most clearly recently by Victor and Leo Radzowski, who derived expressions for these. But let me just state some of the results in a simple limit. So we can write U and V as being given by some function g of r e to the I n theta e to the minus I n theta, and you notice that u is equal to v star, consistent with what I just said here. And now this function g of r one can find by solving the differential equations that one could construct out of this, but I'll just write down its form in a particular case where things are simple, which is when the chemical potential is small compared to mv delta squared. To give some intuition as to what this means, it's helpful to note that this is equivalent to saying that what one would usually think of as being the healing length given by the mass and the chemical potential, if this is much smaller than a new length scale that emerges in this problem, which is set by the this velocity v delta, so if it's much smaller than v delta over mu, which I'll define to be R0, then this limit is satisfied. So in this case, the functions are just functions of this length scale R0, and g of R is then 1 over root R e to the minus R over R0. And if I am careful with signs, what I should show is that this is equal to e to the minus mu times R over the magnitude of V delta. So these are just solutions to this differential equation. And the point that I want to make is that here we have minus mu. And so this zero mode is only normalizable if mu is positive. That is, if we're in the weak pairing phase. If we're in the strong pairing phase, all of this analysis applies equally well. However, the function that you derive at this point has got a growing exponential. It's not normalizable, and so we have no localized zero mode. There's another convenient aspect of this limit, which is that in this limit, one can show that the only bound state on the vortex core is the zero mode, and there are no other bound states before you reach the continuum at the gap of the bulk superfluid.
Was this n equals a zero?
For any of those, the differences in these functions, the principle of this function depends on n, if you say. The differences are all bound up in, on length scales of this size, and so they disappear into on a shorter length scale.
So, like, you've got lots of zero bounds with different angular momentum.
Yes.
But they're all nodular, I mean, they're all, they haven't got any radial nodes.
That's right. So for any odd angular momentum, you can construct a zero mode of this type.
I'm not understanding you at least. I was thinking about the angular variation and the excitation rather than the other.
No, so this n is tied to the vortex.
So in fact, there's no relative angular momentum in addition to that.
You can look at those excitations, but they are not bound states.
Yeah.
They're in the they're scattering states. That's right.
So I just want to explain this limit. So this mu is much less than n v that is there. So this is not, this is in the weak pairing side, but still very far from the BCS limit, is that correct?
So while this becomes true, as we approach the BEC, the mu tends to zero,
yeah.
So we can imagine approaching and,
okay.
So, yeah, that's right.
So it gets better as you go towards the BEC.
That's right. I should, of course, be careful to check how V delta changes, but I think it stays finite, and so this is... That's right. Yes, because it's
increase and mu tends to decrease.
Yeah.
So this becomes better.
Right. Okay. So now, let me see. So
of course, you know, with that regime where the gap is controlled by mu, by delta.
That's right. Yes, because that's right. The gap, because then, if it's too small, then it's it's a gap. We don't see the structure that we're looking for is too close to the continuum. That's right. Okay. So, one thing I need to do is just to go ahead and explain how these relate to Majorana modes. So we find some particular solution of the Bogle-Wilhoff-Degen equation, and we can look at the operator alpha associated with this. So we have u of r. Psi of r, v of r, psi dagger of r. And now it's instructive to consider the creation operator, so the complex conjugate of this operator. But now we have u star, but u star is equal to v. So here we get v of r times psi dagger of r. And v star is equal to u. And so you see that the conjugate of the operator is the operator itself. So this is what one refers to as a Majorana fermion. Its creation operator is the same as the destruction operator, and so it has the, in appropriate normalization, you have this anticommuter to one. So there's much that I could say about the properties of these Majorana fermions on the vortices, let me not spend time on that. Let me just point out that if we now have a collection of vortices which are far apart compared to this length scale R0, then we expect that there should be one of these modes on each of these vortices, and this mode will have an energy that's close to zero with a splitting that's exponentially small in the separation between the vortices compared to R0. So there's a whole slew of these low-energy or zero-energy modes, and in fact, if one counts these appropriately, you'll find that there are of order 2 to the, half the number of vortices in the system. Yeah.
Symmetry that's keeping them at zero energy. And I'm wondering if in the real world there are small perturbations that might change it.
So one perturbation is to bring two vortices close to each other.
Even if I had a single vortex, suppose I had a single vortex. In atomic physics, is there something that might affect it?
Well, it will be split by the, so if I have a single vortex, I have the edge of the system.
Right.
It'll be split by the distance between the vortex and the edge of the system divided by R0, e to the minus that.
That's the only...
That's...
What about the third dimension? I mean, you're assuming these things are two-dimensional.
Yes.
But they live in three-dimensional space.
Yes.
Is there degrees of freedom?
Well, those are all... at some energy scale that's gapped again, so I mean that's, you know, the next degree of freedom by the confinement, which we assumed is let's say there's a harmonic confinement, so there's a set of harmonic oscillator levels. Essentially, I'm assuming that all of the relevant energy scales for the particles are small compared to the spacing to the next subband. So then the next state, you know, the next three-dimensional physics comes in.
That's another megahertz.
It depends on the situation. It's not in a typical experiment where you just have, if you just had a magnetic trap, then it's actually relatively small. So you have to work hard to get into a quasi 2D limit. But if you make something, if you use like an optical lattice, say to slice this up into a very large number of layers. Not if you, if the optical lattice is deep enough that you cut it into an individual slice that don't talk to each other.
I guess I don't know what's the typical frequency for your confinement in an experiment.
In the optical case, I don't know the figures offhand, but it's huge. Much larger than the Fermi energy or any intrinsic energy scale.
So it's like. Much larger than tens of kilohertz, you're saying?
Yes, much larger, by orders of magnitude, maybe 100 times larger.
Okay.
It can be made, for the optical lattice, it can be made very, you can make very tight confinement in that way. But in other cases, the confinements may not be quite so strong. So in some experiments you have in quasi-2D systems, the confinement is rather weaker, and then you might worry about that as a possibility.
And in the strong, tightly confining optical lattice, the atoms in the different layers aren't really interacting.
That's right. Yes, that would be. That's right. That's right. You can make the tunneling as small as you like. You can make the tunneling extremely small in a deep optical lattice. Right.
I reckon that people studied the costless balance transition in the BEC condensate of slice by this optical, one-dimensional optical lattice, so it forms forms these pancakes which don't talk to each other, and each of them undergoes costless balance transition as a function of temperature, and we'll have a talk at the conference about it. But presumably, we'll be told exactly what the and how two-dimensional these guys are, how well they talk to each other.
Could I ask you a slightly different question? So, how I understood correctly, the Majorana fermions, at least the ones associated with these bad states, go away when mu goes to zero.
That's right. Because you can see that.
Yes. But do they then stick it? Is there anything left just at the continuum, the bottom end of the continuum, any residue of them?
I don't know the answer to that. Okay.
Suppose I have one vortex. Your formula looks like you get root two levels.
I've assumed here. Sorry, I've assumed that I have an even number of vortices. Sorry, this formula holds if I have an even number of vortices. And essentially, the way to understand it is to say that for every pair of vortices, I have a two-level system. So. If I have an odd number of vortices, then actually there should be, on the edge of the system, there should be a Majorana mode as well. And so I should pair the Majorana mode here with the mode on the edge. I guess I could write down a formula that allows for, if it is odd, that I allow for the fact that there's something like a Majorana mode on the edge. So of course it is an integer in the end.
But even now, we don't constrain the overall super selection channel, right? Because in principle, it should be that much, I mean, 2 to that n over 2 minus 1.
In, because of the particle numbers, yeah. I know, but I look, I can't get through it, everything.
I have a 30-second kind of question.
Yeah, sure.
So is it just the u equals b equals to 1 over square root 2, or is it more sophisticated than that?
Where? The u equals, go ahead.
It's a zero mode, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you say u equal to b star.
Mm-hmm.
U squared plus V squared presumably should be equal to 1.
Yes, well, just be correct. These are functions.
Right.
Yeah, so U of R is given by this function, and it's the sum of modulus squared, U squared plus V squared integrated over space. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, let me just cut to the final points and just state the final answer rather than go through much more of this. So the point, to summarize quickly, the point is that we have these excitations, which are zero energy excitations on the cores of the vortices. And the point is that in RF absorption, these will give a signature. So we can act to destroy a particle in this Majorana mode, and we'll get a non-zero weight. Independent of the state of these vortices, we'll get a non-zero weight to remove a particle from this zero energy state. This costs us strictly zero energy relative to the chemical potential, and this particle will be ejected up into some state of the other hyperfine level. Now, the setup that we have in mind, just to be clear, we have this quasi-2D condensate, and we'll introduce vortices by rotating at some frequency omega. And so as in usual superfluids, we'll say that the density of vortices is increases with the rotation frequency as twice the mass of the pair times omega over Planck's constant, which we can define to be 1 over some spacing between vortices squared, L squared. And the calculations that we've done are in the regime where mu is much less than m b delta squared. So as I said here, there's only one bound state on each vortex. And we've also only considered the situation where the distance between the vortices is comparable or larger than this length scale R0, so that the vortices are relatively weakly coupled. And we can think of the Majorana modes as approximately independent. We've actually solved for the case where we have a vortex lattice and allowed for the tunneling of the Majorana modes between the vortices. But the main results can be understood just by considering the limit of no coupling between the vortices. So let me just state what the answer is in that case. So if we have no tunneling between the vortices, the size of the core state is small compared to the spacing, then we have to think about what the final states are. Now we're in a rotating frame. In the rotating frame, the final states of the up atoms actually feel a Coriolis force, and these organize into Landau levels. So the final states have a Landau level spectrum with a cyclotron frequency which turns out to be twice the rotation frequency. And so what we find is that the the absorption spectrum is given by, from one vortex, will be given by some rate. Then we have a sum over lambda levels of the final state given by n. There's some weight theta of n, which is the amplitude to go from a Majorana mode into one of these lambda levels. And then we have a delta function. Then we have the energy of the Majorana mode, which was zero, the energy of the final state, which is, well, I'm not using h bars, n plus a half. This is measured relative to the chemical potential, so it's minus mu. Then I have plus Eg minus omega. And these widths are related to the overlap of the Majorana mode wave function with states in a given lambda level and have some particular form that's given by R0 over L squared. So let me just plot the qualitative form of this spectrum. So this was the expression for one vortex. If I had nv weakly coupled vortices, of course, this would just scale like the number of vortices if we neglect the coupling between them. So if you remember, for the weak pairing phase, we had a threshold for the bulk at eg, which there was some step here. And now what you see is because we can make zero modes, here the an n can run from zero, then this frequency can start at a much lower frequency, well, starting at roughly Eg minus the chemical potential. And then we have a series of delta function peaks with these weights that fall off with n, which correspond to the excitations from the Majorana modes into states of different lambda levels of the final state particle. And in the regimes that we've been discussing, it's straightforward to show that you have many peaks in before this falls off, and the decrease of this happens well before you reach this threshold. So the signatures of the Majorana modes are this series of sharp peaks that's well separated from the edge of the continuum. Now, just to state some of the other results, we've gone beyond this to allow for the fact that we may have tunneling between the Majorana modes, and in that case, the modes broaden into bands, and each of these delta function peaks is replaced by some band absorption that has Van Hove singularities that are characteristic of the vortex lattice. We've also considered the limit where we have strong repulsive interactions between the final state atoms and the initial state atoms, as I described earlier. And in that case, you can think of the final states as being as forming states where the atoms are tightly localized close to the cores of the vortices. And so one has a set of tight binding bands for the final state atoms. And in that case, it turns out that one can calculate the spectrum exactly as well. And one finds that it still has the same qualitative form. It's just that these separations, which were set by the cyclotron frequency here, are now set by the band gaps between these bound states of the final state atoms on the cores of the vortices. So this is essentially the main point of the talk and where I wanted to get to. Hopefully, it shows that there are clear and striking signatures of these Majorana modes, which could be observed in RF absorption if one was able, firstly, to create these PX plus IPY condensates, and secondly, to generate vortices in this way. There are other things I'd be happy to talk about, but since time has run on so late, at this point I'll stop and thank you for your attention.
The spacing or something like that. I mean, I could have zero modes due to some other interactions with the axial fermionic modes.
Well, they. I think that they. I can't think of a simple way. I mean, the way that it appears here is essentially in the overall absorption strength. Is a factor of 1/2, because every time you try and remove a particle, you only get half as much as you had hoped to, because...
How would that appear in the plot? Here?
Well, so this would just, it would be the weight on these peaks, right? So if you, right, so we know what the weight, the integrated weight in each of these peaks would be, and there's a factor that's been absorbed into this, which accounts for the fact that these were Majorana modes. If they were not Majoranas, then there'd be something like a factor of 2. In the overall weight. Yeah.
Is there some way of thinking of these Majorana modes in terms of solitons of the condensate field? It's sort of like a winding number going around.
Well, there, I mean, so there are excitation. I mean, of course, there's a the condensate itself has got a vortex put in it. So that by that the fact that there's a the very fact that there's a vortex there is a soliton or it's a point defect of the condensate. Now we're asking about so we're asking about the spectrum above that.
Using these, you might be sort of part of the condensate.
Well, they are in that the I mean if one solves self consistently, one should fill up. You know, there's a set of you should construct the ground state to be annihilated by the U's and V's, and so one should fill up states such that you fill the part of the excitations that have got negative energy and leave the positive energy excitations as unoccupied. But as far as the zero modes are concerned, there's only a very small number of those. There's one for every vortex, right? But the vortices are far apart compared to the spacing between particles. So the actual influence of an individual Majorana mode on the condensate, the background condensate wave function, is negligible compared to the influence of all of the other particles that are condensed in other modes. What's that? I don't see how to make the connection. I'm not saying it's not. I just don't.
You remark that the ground state is actually a multiple degenerate because it
yes.
By not occupy these states.
Yes.
But that picture does not depend on which of the wave functions, you're in.
That's right. So this does. So whenever they're the vortices are far apart, and they're the this when it, there's a certain weight in this peak, and the shape of that peak can depend on what state the vortices are in. So if I let's say I bring the vortices very close together and they form some tight binding band, then I will care about which of this, you know, there's an ordering of the energy of the vortices, and I'll care about, so there's an ordering of the energy of the Majorana modes, and I'll care about whether I'm in the ground state or whether I'm in excited state or whatever. That will change the absorption spectrum. However, the weight in that absorption spectrum is independent of what state I'm in. And so, in particular, if I go to the limit where they're far apart, that this is just a delta function, then the total weight that I see is, you know, the height of the delta function is independent of the state of the system. So one can show that it's if you have an isolated Majorana mode and you try and pull a particle out of it, you'll get the same amplitude no matter what state the system is in. I mean, I can show in a couple of lines. It's quite easy to do, but that's.
It's somewhat counterintuitive, right? So, because you could say it's either occupied or it's empty.
Well,
to pull out the particle. I think I understand why.
Well,
there are
a couple of things. One is that the particles are. You have to distinguish Majorana modes, Bogoliubov fermions, which can be particle and hole, and real particles and holes, right? So let me just say quickly what I have in mind. So imagine that I have two vortices, but I'm only going to act in one of them. But I put the second one in, as you well know, in order to have the possibility to think about ordinary fermions. So I have a Majorana mode alpha 1, a Majorana mode alpha 2, and I'll make a conventional fermion by combining them in this
so
way.
One and two are the Majorana modes associated.
Yeah, with each of these, right?
So very non-local object.
Yes, it's very very non-local, right? The state of the pair of these can be either 0 or 1, okay? And let's imagine that the system is in some state that's some linear superposition of these. Of course, it could be in some reduced density matrix, and then this is one of the eigenstates, and I'll just think about what happens here.
That's a funny superposition. You make some states with different fermion number.
Let's imagine it's a subset of some very large system, and then I there may be an overall constraint on the fermion number of the whole thing, but I imagine that within there is.
Usually with fermion.
Is that okay? I mean, if
yeah, no, there's something happening at the edges that compensates.
Okay. So if.
First of all, it depends, you know, strictly speaking, it depends on the total of particles, odd or even, or something like that.
But it doesn't matter if I view this as being a subsystem of a larger one. Let's say I have a reduced density matrix, then then that can be in any general state, and so I'll take one of its eigenvectors to be the state, and I'll do the other eigenvectors being the orthogonal one.
But probably the coefficients have to be Grassmann variables or something horrible.
The coefficients of these states.
If you're going to mix things with different fermion number, don't you have to use Fermi coefficients?
I don't understand. I'm not doing anything.
These are just ordinary complex formulas.
I mean, I've traced that over all the. Okay. Well, I can. Let me stop and then we can discuss. So if I, let's say I try and remove a particle from here, so I act with an ordinary, you know, like with the rail, spin down destruction operator here. So since it's localized in this region, it can only couple to mode alpha 1. So I'm going to act with something that has some part of it that looks like alpha 1. So but alpha 1 is equal to c plus c dagger over root 2. So if I act with alpha 1 on psi, then I'll get A times 1 over root 2 plus B times 0 over root 2. So I always get a state. I always do find that there's a state. I don't just annihilate. I do find a state that I've created. And the norm of the state is just 1/2, independent of A and B. If this was a normalized state, then this has just got a weight, which is 1/2 of that. So in that way, you can argue that independent of what the state of the system, if you act locally with some destruction operator at one Majorana mode, you'll get some absorption spectrum that is independent of the state of the system. It's just related, has these factors of 2. Okay.
You make it kind of local measurements, really, it's density local measurements, so you couldn't get information about the Majorana. State of the fermionic
okay.
Warp, which is not
located
for aid and for things like that to
no, okay, that's,
actually tell if there is any.
No, that's a good way to say it as well. Mm-hmm.